Well, here it is, Friday, and what I like to call the best day ever invented. You're right in the middle of June. It's a little gray outside, but that's okay. You got the whole summer ahead of you. Father's Day is on Sunday. Things are good.
And it actually feels like summer for the first time in quite some time.
It does. Yeah. It feels like summer.
I used to always love that song by The Cure, Friday, I'm in Love, but now I love it even more.
Mm-hmm. Because why? What changed?
We play it every Friday, which is the best day ever invented.
Yeah. Yeah. So true. So true. Let me share a moment with you and tell me what you make of this. As you know, I'm going through some medical problems.
You're going through puberty, I thought you were going to say.
I'm also going through puberty at the exact same time, which makes both processes even more nerve-wracking. There's so much going on in my life right now. So many feelings I don't understand.
Whoa.
Feelings. All right. So I go to visit a medical specialist to help me decide what my plan of action is with my leg, which for those of you who don't know, I injured playing tennis on Monday.
You pulled what muscle?
My nostrocnemius or something like that? Gastrocnemius muscle.
I have never heard of a muscle like that.
Oh, I looked it up. It's real.
Last time I saw you, you kept telling people you pulled a thigh muscle.
Yeah, and that's wrong. I'm not good at anatomy, as it turns out. All right. So it's the largest muscle in your calf, and I ran for a ball and I tore it, and all right. So I'm on crutches and I'm in pain. So I go to see a medical specialist the other day, and this part of the story has nothing to do with medicine. I just needed to establish the reason I was in this building. It's a medical building and it has 7 floors in it. And I get on the elevator on the bottom floor and I'm going up to see this doctor, and 2 floors up, the door opens and in walks a family. Your traditional nuclear family, a father, a mother, a son, and a daughter. And the kids are, I'd say, between the ages of 5 and 7, right? So they get on, and here's what happens. Nothing. They just get on, and they wait, and the father hits the button to go to whatever floor they were going to. And I just sat there, and I said to myself, when I was a kid, every time we got in an elevator, my brother and I, it became a battle as to which one of us was going to hit the elevator button, because a miracle would happen. You would press a number and it would light up, and that was something to us, and then you were magically whisked to a new floor.
Pretty exciting for a kid.
So exciting. So much so that when we would visit a building that we knew had an elevator, like if my dad would say, we're going to visit grandma on Sunday, we would already start going, I get the button. I get to hit the button. And then the fairness rule was whoever hit it when we arrived, the other one of us would get to hit it when we left. You know, so there was
some you were even Steven.
Fairness in the universe, right.
Or even Adam.
But because my brother's name is Adam. So is that now lost on today's kids? Is the thrill of hitting, and it was a thrill to hit the elevator button. You'd get this feeling of pride.
It was just fun.
It was fun.
And the parent would make a big deal about it,
right,
and say, all right, who's going to hit the button?
Right.
Could you hit number 7? Just 7.
Right. And sometimes, like, other people would get on the elevator and you would act
yep.
as the, like, where,
what
you,
floor,
where you
please?
Headed. You know, and then you could hit the button. You get
and
two
they
for
let
one.
You.
Yeah. On today's kids, or these kids anyway, there was not a single ounce of that. And I got sad because I thought to myself, I get it. You're 5 and you're 7 and you could pull out a phone and you could save a universe or be a race car driver or whatever game you have, World of Warcraft, whatever. So the little thrill of just hitting a button and having it light up and then go somewhere, lost.
See, that's why I don't judge people, because maybe they live in a high rise and they do it every day and it's really no big deal to them.
I would give that to you, except that when I was that age, if we did live in a high rise, and I used to beg my parents to move from our house to a high rise so that I could hit a button every day, I would still, like, that would have never been lost on me. Like, every single day when I did it, I'd go, well, there it is again.
You still get excited when we ride up together.
A little bit.
What floor, Wendy? Same one you're going to?
That's right, 7. Let me get that for you.
I'll drive.
Right, right. But isn't there like a little bit of sadness, like how something like that, and I've told you this before, when I was a kid, I would spend hours with a GAF Viewmaster just looking at those little, all right.
So Niagara Falls was my favorite.
That was one of the classics. So you could put that in and you would just look at the little pictures. You'd look at it for a while and then you'd hit the button and you look at another picture.
And you were in awe.
In absolute awe.
Me too.
Yeah, it was like
that was your HDTV.
How could something so fantastic be in my closet?
It really was pretty cool.
But that's another thing that a kid today, if you gave a kid a Viewmaster, he would sue you. You would go, don't waste my time with this.
I don't know. My kids kind of get into the old stuff, as they call it, vintage, as they call me vintage.
Yeah.
My sister brought over a game of Booby Trap. I don't know if you remember that.
Sure.
For hours they played with my sister.
Did they? Good.
For hours.
Good.
And then every time she comes over, did you bring Booby Trap? So I just think, you know, it's new to them to do this vintage stuff. I think a kid today would still enjoy the ViewMaster.
I hope so.
The buttons, I don't know.
Because I explain that. I've never shown one to my daughters, but I've explained it to them. And they go, and you would just look at the picture? And I go,
well, it
was
3D.
It was 3D.
And it was something about the mechanism sound, too.
Right.
As you change.
Right.
Kind of a swoosh and a click.
It was lit from behind.
Yeah, it was a thing of beauty.
I use them as a kid, too, so not even that long ago, they were still around.
There was like, you would go to Toys R Us or something, and there would be an entire rack of 150 different options. You know, you could look at Peanuts characters doing something. You could do the travelogue ones where you'd be in France or something, Niagara Falls, like you said. But I don't think, like, as I've explained it to my daughter, they go, and then what would happen? And you go, you just look at the picture, and they go, and that's it?
God, we had such an elongated, a long box filled with all those slides.
A shoebox or something?
No, it was like a, I think it was a ViewMaster carrying case or something, because it was really heavy-duty plastic, brown on the bottom, beige on the top, and it just was filled with all these slides.
I had a little console with a 45 record player on top.
Yeah.
And a little TV screen, it would be a monitor below. And a film strip.
Oh, that's excellent.
So the film strip would pop up while the 45 played the story.
Oh, that's excellent.
You must have been rich.
Oh, it's the envy of the neighborhood.
That is really cool.
Well, you do pose an interesting question, because even to this day, I'm not as excited as you are to hit an elevator button, but there is some thrill to it.
Well, it's just because I've tried to analyze this, and I think it's just the mechanics of all I need to do is hit this, and A, it lights up, and that's cool. Because I don't know what makes it light up, but it does. And then, you know how an elevator works, then you're in another world. But I'm watching these kids, and there wasn't even like an ounce of, can I hit this? My brother and I would have fought.
Maybe their parents are very, very strict.
Maybe. It's possible, I guess.
There's got to be some reasoning behind it.
I just think that that's something that, even though it's just a generation ago, it meant something to a kid, and now a kid is like, I'm going to waste my time even hitting a button.
Let's see what the listeners have to say about this. 312-981-7200. Why is it not fun? What's the deal with the elevator button?
Right.
Why don't kids like to hit it and light it up?
Right. What's gone wrong? Come on, Obama. All right. We'll take a quick break. What are your thoughts? 312-981-7200. Enjoy hitting those telephone buttons as you call us or text us. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. I'll catch you up really quickly. I get into an elevator yesterday, and a family gets on, two little kids. And in my day, back when I was a kid, when things mattered, Wendy, a kid would have fought another kid for the privilege of hitting an elevator button. But these kids couldn't care less. The elevator buttons just stared at them, and they
didn't
even
move forward. They just got in quietly.
Not even a little bit.
Were they on their phones?
Nope. Nope.
I've never seen a kid so well behaved. Seriously.
Something was wrong with these kids, obviously.
All right, so
what happened?
What did happen?
I don't know.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
I'm good.
What do you think the explanation is of this?
Well, it's two things. One, when we were kids, we didn't ride in elevators that often. I have a 9-month-old granddaughter. I live in a high-rise condo. She lives in a high-rise condo. And when we walk into my building, the building doesn't look like her building, the lobby.
Sure.
So she's unhappy. She's not, you know, when I'm babysitting, she's screaming. We get in the elevator. She quiets. She knows what an elevator is.
Yeah.
It looks exactly the same as the elevator that her parents live in.
Does it excite her, though, to hit the button?
Well, she's 9 months old.
Oh, so she doesn't even
know.
No, but you got to be 10 months.
She licks it.
Right. That's right. That's healthy.
But, I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't know anybody who lived in a high rise.
I didn't either.
No.
You'd go to Marshall Fields or somewhere, but it was always something special.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I don't know. All right. Well, Karen, thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
Bill, somebody may have a really good explanation.
I hope so.
You were in the elevator first?
Yes.
Somebody thinks, 847 says, Bill, I think the parents were considerate of you. The kids probably hit the button when the elevator's empty.
I'm going to say no, because they didn't even look over at the console of buttons. Like, they had no interest at all. It's just, and it was baffling to me, because I wanted to, like point it out and go, look at all the buttons. You can hit any one of these buttons. No, no interest at all.
What would have been worse, if the kids in there hit every single button?
No, because I would have helped them. I would have gone, yeah, that's what you do in a situation like this. Look at all the options.
All right. Sandy's on the line. Hi, Sandy. What's the deal with this?
I don't know, because I'm with Bill 100%. When I was a kid, I had a concussion, and I had to stay overnight in a hospital.
Yeah.
And I snuck out of my bed in the middle of the night and rode the elevator half the night until they caught me.
It's a good time, isn't it?
How old were you?
I was 7. And it was the best time I probably ever had. But when I got back in my room, they actually tied me down.
Oh no.
That stinks.
Oh, wait, I had a concussion. You can't be up and running
yeah.
around.
Can't be hitting buttons after a concussion. It's dangerous.
I'm telling you, that's what they said. I thought it was fun.
Yeah.
I don't know.
All right. Well, we're glad you're feeling better. All right.
I just got over it last week.
Sometimes they linger for a while.
Thank you, Sandy. Somebody says it's a 2 or 3 year old would be more excited about it. Maybe they're too old, but I don't think so.
It lasted when I was a kid.
It still is going.
I still get a little tinge of excitement when I'm in the elevator and I go, I get to hit the button. This is excellent.
My 5 and 6 year old grandsons fight over the button so much. If you don't get involved, we stop on every floor. It is.
That's beautiful.
Odd that this family.
So my parents would—they put this law into effect because my brother and I would get nuts whenever we were in a building with the buttons. We would—I mean, it got physical as to who was going to hit the button. So the law was whoever hit it on the way in, the other person always got to hit it on the way out, just to balance things out.
That is so fair, and I'm surprised you adhered to
that. No, that's even as a child, I go no.
You didn't even trick Adam into
no, because that did seem equitable.
He learned about sharing.
Not a maniac with the elevator buttons, but...
Well, 412, evidently her daughters were maniacs. My daughters, age 43 and 40, used to argue horribly over who would hit the elevator button. They'd fall all over each other to get there first. Thanks for the memory. I think kids wear out their fingers on their phones.
That's it. That's it. My dad used to threaten us. He'd go, you know what? We're not going to come and visit Grandma anymore if you guys act like this. Fine.
Maybe the parents are germaphobes and told the kids not to touch anything. That from 630.
I don't know if they're germaphobes. I couldn't tell what country they're from. Oh my God. Possible. I don't know.
Maybe because this is interesting.
Hit 9.
Are you finished?
Yeah.
No one thinks he's finished.
312 says maybe because it was a girl and a boy, because I have 3 boys, 7, 10, and 13, and they still fight for the button every time. So I don't.
It might be more stimulating for boys.
No, I love doing it.
Yeah, my kids fought over
it. Yeah,
that's
a sexist thing.
All right.
I'm just wondering, was the girl in a dress?
Oh, I don't remember that.
Why?
Why would that matter?
You're like your Karnak. Was the girl in a dress?
Because maybe she was a girly girl and didn't want to act up.
They were germaphobes. They were wearing lederhosen.
I want to start my weekend now. Although we can't, because we're going to talk to somebody who knows about aliens.
Oh, excellent.
And tattoos that can actually talk to you.
Yeah. That's all on one show.
Aren't they the same thing?
No, separate.
No,
separate.
This, like, audio-wise, can talk to you.
Right. We talked about this when you were away, Steve.
No, I think I remembered, because
she
wants to get one. I think one of you should get one.
Maybe.
Yeah, I might.
All right.
They started, you have to go to special tattoo artists for it, but we'll find out all about that. And Bill, since you like buttons so much, why don't you hit this one?
All right, I'm going to hit it. Stick around. There's more of us. Bill and Wendy on WGN. Hit it.
Mulder, I think there is life out there. I can't move my jaw very well. I'm Scully.
Oh, no. What happened to your jaw? That's awful.
I kind of talk like that,
yeah,
sort of.
Yeah, sometimes.
It's Bill Leff, Wendy Snyder, a.k.a. Fox Mulder, and Dana Scully. And I'm telling you, when the X-Files first came out and I watched it, and there were Alien Area 51 episodes, it made me happy because I really believe in life out there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a guy in the studio with us right now whose new book, The Close Encounters Man, is with us. His name is Mark O'Connell. Mark, how are you?
I'm doing great, Wendy. How are you?
Pretty exciting. Now, you have written for several episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation.
That's right.
You have some feature film projects that are in development with, what, Disney, DreamWorks?
Okay,
who
that
else?
Should be past tense. I've had projects that have been in development.
That's
with,
excellent.
With DreamWorks Animation and Disney.
That's yeah. excellent. Congratulations.
Thanks.
And you believe in UFOs. You believe in life out there, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can't look at the evidence and decide otherwise. I don't see how it's possible.
Why do you say that? What's going on that makes you say that?
Because so many people for so many years have been seeing things in the sky and, mm-hmm. and sometimes on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
The mountain of evidence, whether it's just personal testimony or in some cases even physical evidence, the mountain of evidence is just too, it's impossible to ignore, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I remember Jay Leno used to do a joke about how come anytime a UFO appears, it appears to Bob Bucci and his cousin Weenie in the middle of a swamp somewhere. Why doesn't it ever happen to important people? What do you say to that?
He's got a really good point. However, there is one very famous case that took place in 1952. It was called the Washington Merry-Go-Round. For two weekends in a row, the airspace over Washington, D.C. was literally invaded by UFOs. They were appearing one at a time, two at a time, a dozen at a time. Happened two weekends in a row. The second weekend, the Air Force was so freaked out that they scrambled some planes mm-hmm. to pursue these objects, and none of the pilots could ever get anywhere near the UFOs. They'd approach the UFOs would just disappear.
Cloaking devices.
Possibly. Meanwhile, and what makes it really convincing is you've got radar at Washington National Airport and at Edwards Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. And both of these control towers are tracking all of these objects on their radar, and they're watching these things appear and disappear on their radar.
So how have they explained this? What is their solution to what happened then?
Ignore it.
No, that's pretty much true. Even though the Air Force had been investigating UFO incidents for about 15 years at this point, when this event happened, they totally ignored the Washington merry-go-round. They did not allow it to be officially investigated, and so it's still unexplained.
Yeah,
because of mass hysteria, because of panic. What? Why do you think? Because they can't explain it?
Well, it's an embarrassment to the Air Force. It always has been. I mean, the Air Force has one job, and that's to keep our airspace safe.
Mm-hmm.
And UFOs proved to the American public that the Air Force couldn't do it. You know, here are these things appearing in our airspace all over the country, day after day after day, witnessed by thousands of people in all walks of life. And the Air Force can't explain them, can't identify them, can't mm-hmm. pursue them, can't do anything. It was a huge embarrassment to the Air Force. And that's where the subject of my book, J. Allen Hynek, comes in. Because they needed to hire a sensible, level-headed scientist
yeah.
to sort of give them cover, sort of help them explain away all of these UFO sightings.
And that man was Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Yes, it was.
Now, he an interesting man. You've written a book about him, so you know this. A Chicagoan, right? He was born here
yes.
in Chicago. I first heard of him because every once in a while when I was a kid, they'd make a movie about UFOs, and they always, to legitimize themselves, would have a quote from him, right? Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and he's a very quotable guy.
Yeah, yeah. He was, wasn't he?
Yeah. And, of course, that reached its peak with the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, in yeah. which Dr. Hynek actually had a six-second cameo appearance.
Yeah, yeah. He's not the one who came up with that term, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That was somebody else, right?
No, Hynek came up with it.
Was that his
yeah.
term?
Yeah. That's why I call him the Close Encounters Man. Yeah, he spent many years in trying to understand and study the UFO phenomenon. As a scientist, his first inclination was to, you know, categorize things, right? So he came up with this list of three categories. Close encounter, the first kind, means that you've made visual contact with a UFO
mm-hmm.
Within a range of about 500 yards. He mm-hmm. figured that was close enough that you can make out details like size and shape and solid outline, things like that. Close encounter, the second kind, involves the UFO having physical effects on the environment, like leaving behind a patch of burned grass or landing gear imprints. Close encounters of the third kind really ups the ante because that includes interaction with alien entities associated with the UFO.
This is going to sound insensitive, but when you think of alien abductions, there's usually an anal probe involved.
Wendy wants to know how...
I can sign up for that. No, shut up, Phil.
Does that sound insensitive?
But I don't think that. Everybody mentions that. I mean, you have, I don't know whether I believe people who say they've been abducted. And again, maybe I'm remembering episodes of The X-Files. But do they perform these tests on us? Why do they do this? What do you think about that?
It's an interesting question. And I know several people. I've met several people and know some people, including some pretty good friends, who have had those kinds of experiences. They've had abduction experiences. And in some cases, some of these people will swear that they have had these abduction experiences over and over and over again their entire lives, starting when they were kids. The thing is, you know, once you sort of enter that realm of, okay, you've already sort of crossed the line into something that's virtually outside normal human experience and virtually impossible to explain, then what happens during that event?
Mm-hmm.
Becomes really, really difficult to deal with, like the whole idea of probes. There's actually a guy out there who apparently makes his living removing alien probes.
Oh, really?
And I think he makes a pretty good living at
they
it.
Live
removing
a, they
probes.
Leave them there? Why would they leave evidence?
Well, see, the whole UFO phenomenon is really inconsistent like that. They're sneaky and sly, and they don't want to expose themselves, and yet they'll leave behind evidence.
What would be in it for them to come and give us colonoscopies? Why would aliens want to do that so much?
Well, I have a theory on this.
All right.
Do you remember, are you guys fans of Monty Python's Flying Circus?
Absolutely.
So. Yeah.
Do you remember a skit they did called Confuse a Cat?
Yes.
Yes.
Loved it.
Okay. Well, look up Confuse a Cat. You listeners, look it up on YouTube. Watch the Confuse a Cat sketch. In my opinion, we, the human race, we are the cats.
Oh.
And the Confuse-a-Cat squad are the aliens.
Right.
So if you look at it that way, the aliens are coming here to basically shake us up a little, to like shake us out of our stupor. To what end? I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that's just it. Why don't they, you know, come forward and introduce themselves? I know that if somebody all of a sudden landed here and said, hello, it would be weird. They don't know if they'd be met with violence of some sort. But why these private things? Why do they abduct people and do these tests? Why can't they just say, make some communication, even if they don't want to land, you know, via digital or something? You know, there is life out here. And why do they want to help us? I know those are 15 questions all rolled into one.
Well, let's hope they want to help us. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who believe otherwise.
Well, in movies, there was always two branches. Like when the aliens would come, they were either here to help us and show us how to make life better, or to destroy us, to overtake us. Right. So which would be the more likely scenario, do you think?
Well, I lean towards they're here to help us in some way. The question is, how are they trying to help us and what are they trying to help us with? I go back to the Confuse-a-Cat allegory. I think
you can use that on us all day long.
Right, you know,
I will not. Yeah,
it's awesome to be able to explain a scientific phenomenon with a Monty Python sketch.
I've been waiting for this day.
What about the Ministry of Silly Walks? Don't you think to some extent that also plays in?
It could be.
Yeah,
maybe that's how you spot an alien on Earth, is that they're walking silly.
Right.
Maybe that's the key.
Right.
No, I mean, you've opened up a huge can of worms. Why are they here? Why are they here? What is their purpose? Nobody knows. That's what we've all been trying to figure out for years and years and years. And Dr. Hynek spent almost his entire career trying to figure that out. And kind of at the end of his career, he almost reached a point where he was kind of like, you know what? It almost doesn't matter who they are or why they're here. Maybe we just need to think about, you know, what their appearance means to us as humans.
Could you be an alien right now and we don't know it?
Well, sure, totally.
You're from Wisconsin.
I am.
So there is.
I am from Wisconsin.
There is something.
I do eat cheese.
Right. I love cheese.
And drink beer and eat bratwurst.
I'm part alien.
But all kidding aside, if they were here, because again, I know this is a device in movies, but they like to mask. They like to look like us. Mm-hmm. So if aliens came, would it be in their benefit to pretend to be us? Is that the
There's a whole sort of current through the study of UFOs involving human alien hybrids. I'm really intrigued by that. Yeah, a lot of people believe that aliens come to Earth and interbreed with us.
Yeah.
And their offspring.
Best night ever.
Yeah. And their offspring. So these human alien hybrids, and the way you can spot them is they are incredibly good looking.
Oh.
According to the, you know, this is according to the mythology here. The human alien hybrids are incredibly good looking people. So you can always spot them in a crowd because it's that's a hybrid. That's the best looking person here.
Yeah.
Do they have a greenish tint to their skin?
No,
and
that
would be big anime eyes.
But they know, would these hybrids know that they are half alien and half human, or would they not know?
Great question.
That is a really great question, and that's like a great plot device for a UFO story, right?
Yeah.
I once heard a UFO expert give a speech where he confided that his son had discovered that his wife was a human alien hybrid. And she had gone on the lam. She had gone on the run because the aliens were trying to find her and bring her back.
Really?
Yeah. And this guy swore to this story. He said, "Yeah, my son's just freaking out. He's going off to search for his wife. He doesn't know where to go, but he's going to go search for his wife and try to bring her back."
Do you know who Tony Rosato was? Tony Rosato was an actor. He was on Saturday Night Live for a while on SCTV. He had a mental illness where he thought that his wife and child had been replaced by aliens.
Oh.
And it's not a common mental illness, mm-hmm. but he wasn't the only person who has this mental illness. There's other people who think that people close to them have been replaced by aliens.
Wow. I have to say, people, I bet, think you're crazy. Do you care?
No, not anymore.
I mean, I really believe there's life out there. I don't know to what extent. When we talked to the late Buzz Aldrin, and at the very end of the interview, and I waited to the end just because I didn't know how he would answer, I said, "Do you believe that, you know, you've been out there? Do you think there's life out there?" And didn't he say, he believes that could be possible? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And other astronauts have done that. Gordon Cooper was pretty outspoken about his belief in foreign life forms.
Yeah, and I put a lot of stock in what a former astronaut has to say about things they've seen out in space. I put a lot of stock in that. You know, and as to what you were talking about as far as, you know, spotting people, you know, in our midst, or what you just asked Wendy about, do people think I'm nuts? You would be amazed how often when you just speak openly about UFOs instead of, you know, acting all embarrassed that you're bringing it up, if you just sort of speak openly about it, you would not believe how many people just in a casual social setting, like a party. We were just at a graduation party last weekend. The subject of my book came up, and I swear to you, three people around this picnic table all said, "Oh, I've seen something.
Really?
I've had an experience." Yeah, and in some cases, they were all family, so they were like, they would be pointing at each other and saying, "Well, you know, he saw something.
Yeah,
you know, she saw something." So it happens all the time.
More common than we think.
Yeah, once people feel comfortable and feel like they're not going to be made fun of,
right,
they will start talking about their experiences. There will probably be 20 people right on the floor of this building who are probably thinking, "Wow, I should go tell them about what happened to me that one time."
We'll take your calls, 312-981-7200. He's Mark O'Connell, and he's written this book, The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. It came out Tuesday. It's available where your favorite books are sold, I would imagine, Amazon and elsewhere.
Correct.
And you have a website, too, in case people want to visit that.
HighStrangenessUFO.com. That's all one word, HighStrangenessUFO.
Okay, we will talk to Mark O'Connell. Continue talking, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy, 720 WGN. Is there life on Mars? It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. We've got Mark O'Connell in the studio. He has written his first book, The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. First and foremost, I want to come out and apologize to Buzz Aldrin. He is with us.
He's very much alive.
I thought he was.
We pronounced him dead.
You did.
I pronounced him dead.
That's the last time I listened to you.
Turns out he was just napping. He'll be fine. He'll have some lemonade and he'll be fine.
So I apologize to that. Also, from the Telegraph, the London Telegraph, a story they did earlier this year. Extraterrestrial life does exist, says the head of NASA, but aliens were not hidden in Area 51. Do you believe in that, Mark?
I have an uncle who actually was stationed at Area 51 when he was in the Air Force.
Uh-huh.
And he has told me flat out, Mark, there was nothing there.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, my Uncle Bob is a very skeptical, rational person to begin with. But yeah, he said, you know, I flew in and out on those runways many, many times. You know, I never saw anything resembling a flying saucer.
So where do all the stories come from, and who does it benefit to make these stories up?
Oh my gosh, that is such a deep question.
Yeah.
The stories just come from everywhere. Do they come? Maybe they just pop straight out from our subconscious. Yeah. I don't really know.
Well, someone started the whole Area 51 thing.
Yeah. Well, the modern era of UFOs began almost exactly 70 years ago. It was June 1947 when the first modern UFO sighting occurred in Washington State. And that sort of kicked off this whole thing. That was 1947. By the time you get just to 1950, just 3 years into this phenomenon, you've got your first sensational paperback UFO conspiracy books hitting the stands. And that's really where a lot of this conspiracy stuff started, was with those books that were published in the early 50s. And they were all bestsellers. People just ate this stuff up. And they started, you know, the saucer crash myth.
Right.
And the Area 51 myth. And the Roswell myth.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
I'm just going to go out on a limb and call it a myth.
Betty and Barney Hill.
Oh,
that was
right.
A huge story. And the one that always irritated me was Whitley Strieber, who was a guy who was a sci-fi writer, and his sales were kind of waning. So all of a sudden, he was abducted by aliens, and he wrote a couple of books about it, and sales went through the roof. So
yes.
that was kind of an opportunistic moment or two, don't you think?
When I first read Whitley Strieber's first true story, Communion, yeah. I have to say, I was probably in my teens or maybe in my 20s. And that book scared the living daylights out of me. I loved that book. It terrified me. But then there was another book and another book and another book and another book. And his theories in each book seemed to get a little more far out with each new book.
Yeah.
And I just kind of started to lose interest.
Yeah.
Mark O'Connell with us. We are out of time, but I am so intrigued by this comment here. This is listener Wendy. You have something in your body. We have 30 seconds here.
Okay, I broke a couple toes a couple years ago, got an x-ray on my foot, and I found a needle in my heel, and I have no idea how it got there. You guys have a picture of it.
You texted it to us?
Yeah.
All right, so...
Needle?
Would aliens do any work where they would insert a needle and accidentally leave it there?
There is actually evidence to support that. Billy, you had mentioned the Betty and Barney Hill UFO abduction adventure from 1961.
Mm-hmm.
When the aliens examined Betty Hill on the spaceship, they did stick a long needle in through her navel, and they said it was a pregnancy test. They didn't leave the needle in her navel, though. They took it out, so I can't explain a needle left in a heel. You wouldn't be doing
wouldn't
a pregnancy
be pregnant
test
there, yeah.
in your heel. So that's a mystery. That's a head-scratcher.
Yeah, it is for me, too.
We're looking at the x-ray right now. It's pretty freaky. Hopefully you're not a hybrid. You'd get better gas mileage, though.
There's that.
Oh, hopefully I'm not pretty.
Wendy, thank you for calling. I don't even know what to say advice-wise to you on that, but thank you for sharing. I can't wait to read this book. I'm not giving it to my husband for Father's Day. I'm reading
Keeping it myself on
Sunday. The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. It's written by Mark O'Connell. Thank you so much for being with us. Get this book. It just came out on Tuesday. You can get it at Amazon or where your favorite bookstores are. And once again, give your website.
HighStrangenessUFO.com.
H-I or H-I-G-H?
H-I-G-H.
Okay.
HighStrangenessUFO.com. And there's a blog there where people can contact you as well, correct?
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you, Mark. Great to
Thank
meet you.
Thank you both. This
Good
was
luck
fun.
With the book.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate it. We'll take a quick break, then some news, then more show. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Thank you, Steve. It's Bill Leffitz, Wendy Snyder, and Kurt Wagner is here from TVShowPatrol.com. And we are operating without a net today. I don't know what you want to talk about, so we will talk about whatever you'd like.
Unbridled Kurt Wagner, the way it's supposed to be.
Hi.
Kurt. Nice to see you.
My headphones are messed up, but I don't need them. How's it going?
It's going well. A couple things we want to discuss with you. Thing number one is... There's a show on called Carmichael with Jared Carmichael, and the subject matter this week had to do with a shooting. So it was going to take place, I think, the same day as what went on in Virginia. So NBC pulled the episode, correct?
Yes. It was Wednesday night.
Yeah.
And that was the day the Virginia shootings were. And it was they were taking on mass shootings or shootings in general.
Mm-hmm.
They do a lot of – it's one of those comedies that really hits on current and hot topics and talks about them.
So they make a quick decision and say this is just too close to what went on, so we're
probably
not going to show
a good
the episode.
Move.
Yeah, I would imagine. Right. But he's not too happy.
And that's normal for shows to do things like that because, you know, it could be seen as insensitive or anything like that. But Jared Carmichael's not too happy because he feels that the way they handled it was worth seeing on that day.
Yeah.
Who makes that call, though? I mean, obviously the network.
The programming department.
Yeah, I think the programming department. And I'm sure, you know, probably even higher ups.
But we have seen this before. There have been other incidents that are just too close to a storyline. So they will say, maybe at a later date we'll show this, but we're not comfortable showing it now.
Right. And he was just upset because he thought, you know, they did a lot of work to make it sensitive to all, you know, to shootings that had already happened and everything. But
they're not saying they'll never air
air it. They'll air it at some point, but they just, you know, redo the schedule to put it in somewhere else. And they ran a repeat this week.
Yeah. I've never even heard of this show, so I don't know if it's, is it really popular?
It's third season now, I think. It's been on in the summer mostly.
Because this might be a good little publicity thing for him because no one's heard of him before and now.
Maybe.
You know, seriously.
It's not done intentionally, but it could work out
to his benefit.
Right. I mean, it's a funny show and it handles, like, you know, we've talked about how Blackish handles hot topic issues in a funny way.
Yeah.
And they do the same thing and it's often just as, you know, smooth and yet effective as Blackish is. It's just a summer show, so it probably doesn't get as much attention.
I've been telling Bill, and you have to get Showtime, at least for the
30-day trial.
Yeah. I'm dying up here based on comics from the 70s. It's what vinyl was to me, which I loved about, you know, DJs and payola and all that stuff. It would be like that for you in the world of stand-up comedy.
It's the history of 1970s stand-up.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It does feel like that, doesn't it? Like the vinyl of the comedy world.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's based on, you know, apparently if you knew the LA comedy scene in the 70s, you will recognize people. But they don't say that it's anyone specific.
Right. I need to watch it with you.
Oh,
because
right.
I need you to give me a behind-the-scenes thing.
So you're getting characters that are kind of composites of people who – they're not the actual same people.
Right.
They're just composites of similar type stand-ups. Yeah.
But
they
do feature, you know, the key to any stand-up comic, and I'm not giving anything away, is getting on Carson.
Yeah.
So they do have someone playing Johnny Carson who doesn't look very much like Johnny Carson, in my opinion.
Does he act like him? Does he?
A little bit. And they have like a Doc Severinsen and an Ed McMahon, so good. So I was kind of surprised they didn't go better with that. Because everyone else is kind of a...
But they're calling him Carson?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what Bill had said to me, too. Like, if they're everybody else is kind of an image of a brand name, why are they doing Carson? But, yeah, they say Carson, getting on the Carson show.
Right.
It's really good.
Kevin Spacey did a good Carson on the Tonys.
He does a great Johnny Carson impression. He really does.
On Sunday, yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is a story that's a strange one, and I don't know that you're all that up on it, but for some reason, Kevin, our producer, is extremely up on it. There's a scandal involving the show Bachelor in Paradise, right? Kevin, you and I talked about this in the office yesterday for a little bit, and I don't watch the show. I've never seen the show, but apparently it's commonplace on Bachelor in Paradise to get the contestants to sleep with each other.
Yeah, I maybe not necessarily sleep with each other.
No, I don't think they want them to...
They don't?
They want them to hook up, for sure.
Hook up is not necessarily...
I don't think they rule out sleeping with each other necessarily. I mean, the concept of the show is you get all these... ex-bachelor and bachelorette participants who got voted off, or, you know, however that works, and then they pump them full of liquor and see what happens.
So what do you think's going
to
happen?
So they are encouraging them
to
sleep with each other.
Yeah.
But now there's this one contestant, two of them, I guess, a guy and a girl, from what I gather is they were hooking up considerably in a swimming pool, and they were filming it, correct?
Right. Yeah, to my understanding, the controversy falls on one... So apparently she was in not my words, but throwing herself at him or whatever. But there was a lot of alcohol involved in both parties.
Yeah.
And from what I read, the controversy falls more so not on the male or the female in that regard, but the producers not intervening when they should have.
So they've halted production on the show because it's a black mark on the show.
Right.
And I think it was one of the producers who actually said, somebody connected with the show said, this is unairable. We can't show this. This woman is intoxicated.
Well, yeah. I mean, they should have stepped in and prevented anything from happening at that point, which I think they normally do. Apparently, other cast members of the show were seeing what was going on and very uncomfortable by what was going on.
I would imagine. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a messy situation.
And it probably is not going to air, correct?
I don't think they can.
I don't think they have halted production. I'm not sure if they're going to resume it all or not.
Yeah.
But
aren't you a little shocked? No, again, Kevin, I don't see the show, so I don't
Never
know.
Saw
but
it.
But this is the way the show has been built from day one. So I'm surprised it took this long for something like this to happen.
Right.
Were
Especially
there not
Bachelor
cameras there before? Is that the problem
oh,
this time?
There's cameras everywhere. I think normally, you know, when somebody is past a point of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Sobriety? I mean, they're really...
Or coherency. Yeah. Coherency. But yeah, normally the producers would have stepped in, even especially if other cast members are saying, hey,
right.
this is not
too
right.
far.
So
apparently this never used to happen on the Donna Reed show, Kurt.
No.
Never.
No. But it was a very different time. It was very different.
No, you're right. To your point, it was a very different time.
I loved Donna Reed.
No.
I'm well, sure you know, she had a dark
ever,
side.
Have you ever seen that show on Lifetime called Unreal? It's a fictionalized version of what happens behind the scenes at a show like The Bachelor.
Oh.
And it's had two seasons, I think. It's gotten a lot of buzz. But if you believe, and it's written by... I think at least one of the writers is a former producer on one of those.
Oh, really?
Shows, one of those reality
so
shows
they know
like that.
A little bit about
so
what
they
goes
know,
on.
And it's very pointed about how the producers, you know, there are several producers who are in sort of in charge of certain people, contestants, if you will, and how you know they're pressured to get really.
Intoxicated?
Salacious
oh,
scenes, you
right.
know, or to get controversial scenes in order to make better drama.
Right.
And so I wouldn't doubt that certain things happen well, that get a little out of hand and sometimes they don't step in when they should.
The producers on shows, like all those Real Housewives shows, they always talk about how part of their job description is to rile these women up, to
right.
make them mad at each other, to spread rumors about each other,
right.
to make it more interesting,
right.
make the show more interesting. So you know that stuff goes on.
Right, and if you look at this Unreal show, it's incredible. I mean, it's just so devious and evil.
Yeah.
You
know,
I have to watch that,
some of
I
the
think.
Stuff that goes on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably streaming somewhere the first two seasons, but I'm not sure who has it. But it's very interesting, a very interesting look into that.
Kurt Wagner's here from TVShowPatrol.com. If you have any questions or comments, you know how to reach us, right? 312-981-7200. We'll pick this up in just a moment. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Kurt Wagner's here. Speaking of world champions, he's got a great website, TVShowPatrol.com. Visit it. It's on your internet. Kurt.
And on your internet.
And it's on everyone's internet now. All right. So Megyn Kelly for years is over at Fox. And then all of a sudden she's not at Fox and she goes to NBC. But now there's rumors that NBC, behind the scenes, is just a little bit nervous about the hiring of Megyn Kelly, and they're doing what they call uh-oh control. They're a little nervous about
that's
the
That's officially
interviews.
What it's called.
She did an interview with Vladimir Putin a couple of weeks ago, and then there's this one coming up with Alex Jones, who, for people who don't know, is...
careful.
I don't know if I put this politely. He's out of his mind. He's completely out of his mind. All right, so what do we know about what's going on at NBC with Megyn Kelly?
Well, when NBC announced that Megyn Kelly was interviewing him,
yeah,
he's a very controversial figure. He's a guy who espouses all these conspiracy theories, and he
about 9/11 and Sandy Hook.
He believes that the Sandy Hook massacre never happened.
Right, it was staged.
That it
he
was
says.
Staged and made up, and so
much to the chagrin of parents who lost
right.
children.
Yeah. Well, and the parents are.
That's who should be interviewing Alex Jones, the parents
yeah. Yeah.
of the
parents
victims.
Are, you know, have raised a fuss when this was announced.
Right.
That, why are you doing this? You shouldn't do this. You shouldn't air this. So this went on and on, and then Alex Jones sort of piped in and said, yeah, you shouldn't air this. But then yesterday, I think, or
he
yeah, yesterday, he leaked some audio
right.
of the interview and supposedly trying to hijack, you know, and make NBC say, oh, well, since it's out there, we're not going to air it. But... what I believe is he's just hyping the show so that more people will watch. Because I'm sure he just gets a chance to espouse all his craziness on NBC.
Mm-hmm. And here's my question, though, and I was trying to state this in a way you guys would understand off the air, and I don't think I got there. Why NBC's doing control? Why would they allow this to happen in the first place?
Ratings.
It's all, I guess. I mean, it just has to be ratings. And the thing is, it's great to interview him, I think, as a former journalist and still a journalist, sort of, that it's great to interview him as a larger piece about fake news, about, you know, him, and you know, have this longer piece that examines all sides of the issue, and not just let him go. I mean, as we said, I don't know how probing Megyn Kelly's going to get. She has failed to do so in the past, that she's going to nail him down about anything necessarily. So it would be good to see him, like, on 2020 with more people who, you know,
could
doing
delve deeper.
More reporting. Yeah.
But didn't NBC, when they took on Megyn Kelly, they thought that that's what they had in her, isn't it? They thought they had,
they had a controversial a person.
You know how for a long time the go-to was, if you had an A-lister, somebody that was at the top of the heap, you would go with either Diane Sawyer or Barbara Walters if you were ABC. I mean, everybody had one or two people that were at the forefront of, okay, we really have a big interview. Who are we going to send out? And I think NBC thought, well, Megyn Kelly could be that for us. Don't you think?
I think they thought, here's a woman who's gotten a lot of press lately, and we should get her.
Not so much for her interviewing skills, but for what she had been through recently.
I mean, I can't say that for sure, but I just...
Yeah.
She sure
That's
is
just
purdy.
My opinion.
She sure is purdy.
She's an attractive woman. Yeah. Yeah. But, all right, so the interview will air this weekend?
Yeah, NBC announced today that despite what he's done, the interview will air on Sunday.
Yeah.
On her show.
See, I want to wait and see it and reserve judgment until after I've seen it. Everybody's just kind of flown off the handle. Oh, don't give this guy any kind of airtime. But maybe after we see it, maybe it'll be edited in such a way that it proves a point about
him.
Well,
I hope so.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, tell us about Shark Week, because I saw a smiling shark that you tweeted out.
Yes, Discovery has done this. This will be the 19th year of Shark Week.
That long already?
Yeah. And Discovery Networks announced that it was July 23rd to the 30th, but this week they announced the schedule, which I posted on the site. And interesting to me was that Olympic champion swimmer Michael Phelps will be in two shows. Mm-hmm. One of them, he's going to Shark School.
Is Shark School? I don't know what that is.
It's some shark school in the Bahamas. It's at some shark center.
Where you learn about sharks.
In the Bahamas.
Yeah. You don't learn
well,
to
I
become
think it's,
one.
It's a scientific place where they do a lot of, and that's a lot where a lot of these shows that they do, the specials they do, come out of this center.
Uh-huh.
And the scientists who are there. So he's going to learn everything about sharks, apparently. And then in another one, he's going to swim against a shark.
Like a race?
Yeah, like a race.
My money's on Phelps.
Now, I don't know if it'll be a virtual race, because I can't imagine they'll have two lanes. And they'll,
right.
They'll, you
stay
know,
in your lane, Mr.
Fire
Sharky.
A gun and the shark and he will go. Right. Or if they're going to put Michael Phelps in front of a great white and see, see if
I
he can
not.
Survive. See if he can swim away from him. I don't know.
That would be terrible.
Why are sharks so cool? I mean, there are various animals in the world. Elephants are kind of cool. We don't see as many, you know, we don't see Elephant Week. I mean, we don't.
No, we don't. I don't know. Sharks,
God, they're fascinating.
You know, it is. I think it is that whole thing. They're still mysterious, I think. Even
sharks
though
are.
So many things have been done about them, they're still considered the villain of the sea.
Yeah, right.
You know, and
they don't sleep, Kurt. You know,
villains
that.
Are always more interesting.
We're going to need a bigger TV.
You know, you can touch a shark at Shedd
Aquarium.
I did that recently.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Smaller ones.
It was a leopard shark.
Yeah.
Apparently a non-biting leopard shark.
Oh.
Well, that's why they let you touch
it. Much safer. Kurt, thanks so much for being here. It's Kurt Wagner. Again, the website is tvshowpatrol.com. If you're a fan of television, it's a great place to visit. We appreciate you being here.
Sure.
We'll take a quick break. News is next. Stay here, Bill and Wendy, WGN. All right, I'm just going to say this out loud because it needs to be said. We're not in a competition with Steve Bertrand. You and I are not in a competition with him.
He kind of acts like
he's made it a competition. But at 12 o'clock, we kind of split off. Wendy and I, we go to the stream, the internet. We do an hour show there.
We're much more entertaining, by the way.
It's not a matter of much more entertaining. It's a totally different show. Steve Focus is more on business. It's the Wintrust business lunch. And ours is on
all the rest of the good stuff in the world.
All right. All right. So today we
But this isn't sounding competitive at
no,
all right
No, it
now.
Shouldn't
Bertrand
sound competitive.
Bertrand started it.
Of course he did.
Today we have Louise Brown, who was the world's first test tube baby. She's going to be live in the studio. And then also another woman whose name I'm not familiar with.
I have her name.
She was America's first test tube baby.
Right. Louise Brown was the first test. She was the first in vitro fertilization baby in England in 1978. And then in December of 1981, Elizabeth Jordan Carr became the first American IVF baby.
Right. So they will be in studio with us.
There's a Midwest Reproductive Symposium that is going on. We'll tell you all about that. But I'm pretty geeked about this.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. And Steve is just going to, I don't know. I mean, it's up to people. Steve's a longtime friend. I'm not going to downplay anything he's got on the show. But you got the world's first test tube baby and the America's
I
first
know,
test
really,
tube baby.
I know, really. Listen to that.
That's pretty. I can't wait to talk to them. And also, the future of tattoos. We will discuss this. You can now have a tattoo put somewhere on your body that talks.
I'm getting one.
Are you going to definitely get one?
Not today, but yes, I'm going to get one. I think
them?
I am.
All right.
I'm in need of another tattoo. The plane.
Now you're stealing my idea.
Which is?
To get a tattoo. A tattoo of tattoo from Fantasy Island. No one's done that. If I'm going to get a tattoo, that's what I'm going to get, is a tattoo. Or you can listen to Steve, and they're going to have soup on today's show.
I do love soup.
Everybody loves soup. So it's up to you. You have two options.
You're mean.
The scream of consciousness, or the stream of consciousness, or you can listen to Steve. Either way, you're a winner.
The stream of unconsciousness.
And if you can't decide, just split it 30-30.
Yeah.
Or listen to the podcast of one of them. You really don't have to choose.
So much to do. All right. I want to take a moment to talk about this. This is very serious. Sue Hodgkinson is a woman who, a couple of days ago, most of America was not aware of. Her husband, James Hodgkinson, was the shooter in Virginia the other morning. Well, Sue was very outspoken yesterday in saying that this came completely out of nowhere. She did not expect this at all. She didn't. There were no warning signs that her husband could do something as awful as he ended up doing. And you know what I thought of right away is, and we've discussed this a few times, a lot of times you'll see the parents of somebody who's done something awful. You know, if there's a school shooting or something, you'll see the mom or the dad. And how can you not help? I know this sounds crazy, but you feel sorry for them because you say to yourself, well, it's not their fault. They didn't do anything wrong. They're just close to the person who did do something wrong.
And that breaks my heart because, you know, we can't control other people.
Right, right.
We can only control ourselves.
Right.
And I was listening to the press conference yesterday, and Sue Hodgkinson was trying to answer these questions, saying that he closed off his business. He sold almost all of his stuff, which... I hate to say this, but sometimes that's like a suicide warning sign when you purge yourself of all your stuff.
Well, maybe.
It's kind of a weird thing where you just get rid of it. And then he went to work on getting various tax brackets.
Yeah, he explained to her that he needed to go to Washington for that purpose. And if you're her, you believe him, right? There's nothing in his history that would lead you to believe otherwise.
It still sounds strange to me. Like, honey, what do you think you're going to do?
Yeah.
You know? And what about, how are we going to get money? You've just sold off your business and all your belongings.
Right.
But I felt so sorry for her. She was out there to answer questions because basically she just wanted the press to leave her alone and all her neighbors because it turned into like a big bird's nest of press. They're doing their job too.
So when does this go away for somebody? Like you've already lost somebody who meant something to you. Her husband is gone.
Of over 30 years.
Right, right, all right. So that's part one. And then part two is you'll always be the wife of somebody who did something so awful. That's never going to go away, right?
I know. It's heartbreaking to me to think about her.
The wife of Alexandria, Virginia gunman is saying that she is shocked about the attack and she had no idea what her husband was planning. This is according to CBS News this morning. I just don't know what to tell you people. I had no idea this was going to happen, and I don't know what to say about it. I can't wrap my head around it, okay? Sue Hodgkinson said, and I saw this, and it's as legit can be. There's no reason to believe otherwise. She just seems just shell-shocked. It says she was emotional, and she spoke as she spoke to reporters Thursday outside of her home in Belleville, Illinois. She said she thought her husband, James Hodgkinson, had gone to Washington, the Washington area, to work on tax policy. The investigation is focused on Illinois and the scene of the attack in Virginia. The roads surrounding the Alexandria ball field where the shooting took place remain closed as the FBI continues to search the area for any new clues. This, according to CBS News correspondent Chip Reed, the FBI has already recovered two weapons, a 9mm handgun and a 7.62 caliber rifle. A trace of the firearms determined say they were legally purchased by Hodgkinson. Ballistic tests are being done to determine if both were used during the attack. The FBI says the shooter's white van had been processed. Inside that vehicle, agents recovered a cell phone, a camera, and a computer. Also interesting, and part of the story, is that Ted Nugent, who we have talked about several times over the last few years, says that enough is enough as far as he's concerned. He's no longer going to say bad things about people.
If that's true, I commend him for stepping forward. We had Ron Onestian, who was saying how wonderful Ted Nugent's show was at the Arcata Theater,
yeah,
and he really didn't get political, which if he doesn't, I think he gets a little crazy sometimes, and let me take that back, not crazy, over-enthusiastic, would that be appropriate?
Yeah.
I love his music, but I don't know that I'd go see him because he's been rubbing me the wrong way lately, and not in the pleasurable sense.
Here's the quote from Ted Nugent. He says, I'm not going to engage in hateful rhetoric anymore. Now, he's made headlines several times over the last couple of years, being very, very outspoken about how he thinks the country has gone downhill. It says conservative rocker Ted Nugent, who has a history of inflammatory remarks, and he's one of the people who said years ago, and this is during Barack Obama's presidency, that within a year, he's either going to be dead or living somewhere else. And then years have passed, and he's not dead, and he's not living somewhere else. But people on both sides have done that. Alec Baldwin is famous for that, too. If he's president, I'm going to be in Canada. But he doesn't.
But SNL isn't filmed in Canada.
Right.
Or taped or whatever.
Right. He says, Ted Nugent says, I have reevaluated my approach. He told this to Curtis Sliwa on an ABC radio show in New York. Curtis Sliwa is the guy who was the founder of the Guardian Angels, and for the past several years has had a mostly political-based show in New York City. He said he was a street fighter who used certain harsh terms in the past. He did not mention the terms, but he has called President Barack Obama a subhuman mongrel. He also referred to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as a worthless B-word. I don't know if I can say it, but people know what it is.
Boo-boo kitty?
Probably not. Probably not. But he says he plans to watch himself as of now. At the tender age of 69, Ted Nugent is 69 years old, my wife has convinced me that I just can't use those harsh terms. I cannot and I will not, he said, adding, and I encourage even my friends and enemies on the left in the Democrat and liberal world that would have got to be civil, that we've got to be civil toward each other. This is not what I expect from Ted Nugent. Ted Nugent has been kind of on the violent side,
yes,
in the last several years, not somebody who's looking for peace. That the whole world is now watching America, where you have the God-given right here to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and we have got to be more respectful to the other side. If he stands by this, I applaud him.
Me too.
Because this is very uncharacteristic of him of the last couple of years.
Can I just say something, though, that is going to anger a lot of people, but I have to get it out of my heart. I really do.
If you say Wango Tango is the greatest song ever written, I'll have to leave.
Stranglehold was one of the best songs.
That's the greatest song ever written.
If Ted Nugent is able to do this, there are people that are going to heed what he's saying.
I hope so.
Why can't a certain president of the United States say something similar? Wouldn't that mean more?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you saw this. Stephen Colbert the other night, and Stephen Colbert has been relentless in his making fun of Donald Trump the last couple months, as most of the late night talk shows have been. But Stephen Colbert especially, on a nightly basis, he skewers Donald Trump. And he started out the show, now this was the night of the shooting, saying that he thought that Donald Trump did a really nice job of coming on and not making this about himself, as he tends to do, but to say, you know, we need to stand together. And it wasn't him. I think it was Paul Ryan who said something to the effect of, an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. But then Donald Trump kind of mirrored that in his speech. And Stephen Colbert was very honest and just said, I thought he did a really good job with that. And that's something that, again, I didn't think I'd see. So I hope that's progress all the way around. I hope.
But don't we need the president of the United States to say something similar?
It would be nice.
It would be helpful.
Right. And not just say it. Saying it is one thing. Meaning it is what needs to happen. You know, if Donald Trump were to say it with some kind of modicum of, these aren't just words.
Feeling behind it.
Yeah, that would be a tremendous step forward. All right, let's take a quick break. If you want to jump in, you know how to reach us. We're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
It's Bill. It's Wendy. It's 720 WGN. And I was listening to the press conference that Sue Hodgkinson had yesterday down in Belleville, Illinois. She answered a bunch of questions. And there was something that sounded cold to me, but it isn't. And I again, feel sorry for her. She said she had no idea. I don't know what to tell you people. I had no idea this was going to happen, and I don't know what to say. I can't wrap my head around it, okay? She wanted to make a statement so press would leave her and her neighborhood alone. They asked at some point, some reporter said, what would you like to say to the victims' families? And Sue Hodgkinson said something along these lines, like, I'm sorry he did this, but there's nothing I can do.
Right.
It sounded cold, but really, it's
accurate.
It is.
And Wendy, I heard it too. And, you know, what I thought struck me too, when they said, do you have anything to say to the victims? And she said, I don't even know who was shot.
Yes, yes.
But I think she's so...
Shell-shocked a little?
Yes, and her whole world is in such upheaval, because at the very beginning of the press conference, they said, how do you feel about this? And she could barely get the words out, and she was gulping, and she said, horrible, horrible. So I don't think...
She hasn't processed it yet.
That one soundbite kind of did sound cold and calculating if you took it out of context, but really, I think the poor woman is just blown away.
And that's what I wanted to say.
That's what I got from it.
It sounded bad, but it's like when somebody tells you someone close to you has died, it's like everything's a blur for a while until you can go, okay, wait, let me put this all together.
It's even more twisted because after an amount of time, and they'd been together 30 years, right? So you kind of think you know somebody. You know that you know the good in them, you know the bad in them. And then when something like this happens that's just so off the charts bad, you can't reason it. You just go, well, that can't be. I know that guy. I've been married to that guy. How could that have gone down that way? So, yeah, I do. I get it. I feel the same kind of empathy where you just go, I feel so bad for you because now this is something you'll have to live with through no fault of her own. She's got to live with this.
She'll always be the wife of that guy.
She'll always be the wife of that guy. And there was a story about didn't their daughter just move back in with them?
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's somebody else close to him who you just go, my dad did this?
It doesn't compute.
Doesn't register. No.
And they were a foster care family, from my understanding, and had taken in kids and taken care of them.
Yeah.
So, again, we've talked about this yesterday ad nauseum, and people will continue talking about this. There's no way to pinpoint who's going to snap.
No way. I don't know if you get to hear Dick Durbin was on this morning with Steve Cochran. So they did a search through their files to see if at any point James Hodgkinson had contacted the office. And, yeah, on occasion, he would send...
13 emails, I believe, or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. He had sent some emails, and it was about... Most of his concern was about the availability of guns in schools, all right? So they said they had a record of him, that he had sent some emails over the years, but, you know, they get thousands and thousands and thousands of emails, and there was nothing, he said, that would flag him as being somebody dangerous, somebody that needed to be watched.
More than other people who have sent that many emails. That's
right.
True. There's no way to figure this out until after the fact.
Right.
When it's too late.
Yeah. All right. We must take a break. We're going to go upstairs in a little bit, and on the stream... We're going to talk to two people who kind of changed childbirth, the future of childbirth. Louisa Brown, who is the very first test tube baby of all time, and then also Elizabeth Carr, who is America's first test tube baby. We'll find out their stories on the stream. And then Steve Bertrand has a great show coming for you on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
That was nicer.
Not as good as ours, but
okay.
It'll be good.
There we go.
All right. Stick around. Bill and Wendy, WGN.